So good evening, everyone. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome Professor Gary Marks here to this European Institute seminar series labeled Contesting Europe, which Professor Damien Chalmers and myself have organized. I'm sure you all know Gary Marks. He is Burton Craig Professor of Political Science at UNC Chapel Hill and also Chair in Multi-Level Governance at the Free University in Amsterdam. And he's, of course, one of the leading thinkers on European integration, on comparative regional organizations and multi-level governance. Him and Lisbeth Hoche have really reshaped how those of us who study the EU think about it and think about processes of European integration, first with his work on their work on multi-level governance, and then more recently with their work on post-functionalist theory, where he sort of preempted everything that's happened the last few years with the euro crisis and everything by saying that Europe would become increasingly more contested and that the integration process would become increasingly more constrained by public opinion. And of course, that's what we've seen happening. So currently, Professor Marks has a 5-year grant from the European Research Council on the causes and consequences of multi-level governance, where he does something which I think is very important, which is namely to sort of not just look at the EU as some sui generis organization, but look at regional organizations comparatively, and then within that also the EU. And I'm very much looking forward to him sharing some of his findings and insights from that project with us this evening. And I should just also say, as always, that the hashtag for tonight's event is LSE Marks. So without further ado, over to you. Thank you.
Good.
Is my clicker? Yep. Well, good evening, and thank you very much, Sarah, for that introduction. It's a special pleasure for me to be here for at least a couple of reasons. One, my brother Anthony is in the audience. He doesn't often get to see me give a lecture, and I'd also like to welcome Alan and his son Joshua, who is a prospective LSE student. And thank you for the rest of you for turning out and in an evening to hear a talk on the European Union. I want to begin by emphasizing that I'm standing here as a political scientist. And my purpose is to seek detached knowledge, disconfirmable knowledge, scientific knowledge, disconfirmable knowledge about the European Union, rather than to try to convince you that the EU is good or bad or something in between. How one evaluates the European Union depends on what you compare it to. And I'm going to compare the European Union in two broad contemporary and historical ways. And this is what I mean by paragon, the original use of the term. Paragon, not as a moral standard, but as a comparative standard against which you can evaluate other phenomena. Now, Marty Lipset, who was my teacher and actually the most cited a political scientist in the post-Second World War era, used to say that a person who knows one thing knows nothing. To understand, one has to compare. So the older I get, the more I hunt around for phenomena, for institutions, for political events with which I can compare the European Union. My talk has four parts. Let me alert you to what you're going to be listening to. I'm going to begin with two basic principles of government. Scale, the advantage of size in providing public goods, and community, the glue that describes how individuals belong to groups that desire self-rule. These are the basic building blocks that I believe are fundamental to understanding how humans cooperate, and these building blocks are in tension. The pressure of scale is towards larger, more capable, more powerful governments. On the other hand, community pressures government down to groups who want to rule themselves and which hate being ruled by foreigners. So that's the first part. And then I'm going to... Does that work? Then I'm going to compare the European Union in history from a broad historical perspective, from the perspective of large polities in European history going back over 2,000 years. And then I'm going to compare a very different kind of comparison, a contemporary comparison, where I'm going to compare the European Union to other kinds of regional organizations. And then finally, I'm going to return to the European Union and talk about community and scale in the context of the EU as it has developed until the present. Well, this is a, on the left, is the front piece of the Leviathan by Thomas Hobbes, which he published right after the midpoint of the 17th century, following the English Civil War. And the book is famous for arguing that you need a Leviathan, you need an autocratic power in order to constrain a civil war. And Hobbes, I think, was patently wrong about that. But the book has a deeper meaning, it has a deeper purpose, and that is to reveal the reasons, the purpose of government in terms of public goods. And a clue to that is the fact that the emerging figure, the Leviathan, with his sword and crozier, is actually made up of individuals. Individuals who are more than the sum of their parts. And the argument is that they're producing a public good, security, the rule of law, without which, and this is Hobbes speaking now, in Hobbes's words, there is no place for industry because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation, no knowledge of the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Now, this kind of good is no less important and often more important than the other kind of good, the private good that is used up when it is consumed. Public goods have two distinctive qualities. They're non-rival, on the top there. That is to say, they're not used up when they are consumed. And they're non-exclusive, which is to say that it's difficult or impossible to meter the individual use of a public good. Now, when you think hard about this, the range of public goods, goods that individuals could not produce qua individuals, as individuals, is amazingly broad. And here I've listed just four: security, pollution, the rule of law, and knowledge. The lighthouse is another famous example of a public good, very difficult to meter, as are the institutions that underpin economic exchange. Now think about the logic of this, of a public good. If my consumption does not diminish your consumption, then the more people who contribute to the public good, the more we can produce, and or the cheaper it is for each of us. And this is a fundamental insight, and it's an insight that I want to build on. If I had to think of the basic insight of the public goods literature, this would be it. So what are the benefits of scale? Well, scale is fundamental to political power. When it comes to violent conflict, countries with greater populations, with larger, more prosperous economies, usually win. Now, we know the kind of counterexamples. These are famous. They're interesting. But to stand a chance, the weaker side will have to have some special advantage: a narrow pass, remoteness, difficult terrain, a narrow channel of sea. Some countervailing influence against the force of population and economic scale. Think about the reasons why we consider China to be an emerging power. Now, China is a relatively, the individual level of GDP in China is relatively low, not only by comparison to Western countries, it's about one-fifth, one-sixth, one-seventh that of Western countries, but it's relatively poor even in relation to countries that are close to neighboring countries. It has about one quarter of the per capita GDP of South Korea. It has barely more than half of the per capita GDP of Malaysia. The reason we can consider China to be an emerging power is because it is a vast population in a vast and relatively integrated economy. Economic exchange. Scale is important for economic exchange because it expands the scope of trade, it extends and deepens the division of labour, it allows economies of scale in production and distribution. So the larger the jurisdiction, the greater the benefits of eliminating tariffs, of adjudicating demands for protection, of standardising weights and measures, and of having a single system of law regarding contracts. Insurance. Then there's the benefit that scale brings to protection against disaster, flood, earthquake, tsunami, economic shock. By assisting people who are suffering, by mobilizing the resources of people who are outside the areas that are affected. Insurance is actually one of the key reasons for the development of national states. And then collective decision making. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, scale is key in dealing with public bans, where decisions by one jurisdiction hurt another jurisdiction. Think of downstream pollution. An overarching jurisdiction can internalize the effects of its decisions in the same way that a jurisdiction for cleaning up the River Rhine that includes all the effective countries can overcome beggar thy neighbor policies. Now, there's a dynamic here, and that's the term I've used ever upward. There's a dynamic here which actually lies at the heart of the political science of European integration, neo-functionalism. And that is there are a variety of self-creating processes that are based on scale and that would lead one to hypothesize that the effects of scale will actually build upon each other. Because one policy spills over into other policy shifts as new problems emerge and as the benefits of scale become apparent to individuals and firms. Now, scale. Scale is massively important, but it's not alone, for there's another force which is no less decisive in shaping government, and this is what I call a community. Communities, that is, bounded groups of densely interacting humans who share distinctive norms, are a magnet for government, both for what they make happen and for what they stop from happening. They facilitate government because they diminish free riding, which is the bane of the provision of public goods. Individuals consume pure public goods whether they contribute to their cost or not, which is a way of saying that government works better when individuals are willing to make some kind of sacrifice for the commonweal, an idea which is as old as the study of politics. For Plato and Aristotle agreed that a community in which individuals internalize the public weal is a natural setting for government, the polity. Government, in short, works best when there is a social connectedness, interconnectedness, and a shared sense of belonging that raise the cost of defection. However, the term parochial altruism, a very interesting term which has become used in the literature in social psychology, particularly the work of Fair, an economist at Zurich. As the term parochial altruism suggests, communities are double-edged in that the social solidarity that facilitates government within communities constrains government among them. Communities are altruistic, but they can also be parochial, depending on whether their members divide the world, the social world, into us and them, into insiders and outsiders. Distinctive norms and perceptions lead communities to prefer particular packages of public goods and to desire self-rule. That is the authority to make decisions for themselves without outside interference. Now, most people consider themselves to be members of multiple communities. There are communities at different scales, from the international, from the local, to the national, to the international, and even to the global. And so what matters in the application of community to government is how those identities fit together. To what extent is a person's attachment to a community exclusive, so that he or she regards an overarching jurisdiction as rule by foreigners? So that is the, in a word, that is the intellectual, that's the theoretical frame that I have, that I and Lisbeth Hoge have been thinking through in relation to multi-level governance, our project having to do with the authority, shift of authority above the national state and below. But first, I want to turn to a broad historical perspective. I'm really going to be looking at the European Union and European integration with a very broad view, as if I'm trying to kind of capture the European Union in as broad a perspective as one can imagine. And this is a pretty broad perspective, 400 BC to the present. Now, what I've done here is I've excluded every polity in Europe that has an area less than 1 million square kilometres. And there are five empires, polities, I don't care what you call them, that meet that criterion. And each of the bars there is 1 million square kilometres. Well, what is this? It's a fascinating, picture, I think. What is it? What does it show? I want to pull at least two things out of this. The first is that they're very different, very, very different ways of achieving scale from the Roman Empire, which conquered diverse peoples and eventually, under Gracchus, made males Roman citizens, to the Nazi Empire. I'll call this a spike. It looks like a spike. I'll call this a spike empire, both for what it did and for how it looks. The Nazi Empire, which subjugated peoples under the threat of extermination. You can see that the European experience is U-shaped, and the national state is responsible. That is to say, the centralization of authority in national states following the breakup of the Roman Empire and the eventual dissolution of the Frankish Carolingian empires created national states, hard national states, policies where there was a sharp difference between the inside and the outside, the external and the internal. This was a new phenomenon. Let me just say, with the breakup, we're talking about scale. The breakup of the Roman Empire, right at its peak, 114 AD under Trajan, it took around 1,000 years for the peoples of Europe to have the same standard of living as in the Roman Empire. I mean, scale is absolutely fundamental historically to the prosperity of peoples. So, the creation of national states, which made the creation of polities having serious scale vastly more difficult in modern times. And the way in which the Napoleonic Empire and the Nazi Empire did this was by subjugating, by violence, by conquest, peoples who would never accept the suzerainty of those empires. Those were empires that encompassed, I've written a paper on this, which is entitled Europe and Its Empires, which is available on my webpage. And if you don't have the address, that I'd be happy to send it to you. But one of the indications that these were empires that could not succeed in gaining the assent and therefore the productivity of the individuals who comprise them. Aircraft factories in France that were run by the Germans had 1/4 of the productivity of those in Germany. Why would people be willing to produce airplanes for for Germany if they were French. They were almost useless at mobilizing the resources of their conquered communities because they produced hatred and resistance on the part of the peoples they conquered. Did you know that the gross national product of what became Nazi-controlled Europe was as great before the war as that of the United States? But after Nazi conquest, the productivity was vastly reduced. Now, the European Union, by contrast, is a multi-level polity built on accommodation with national and, in some cases, regional communities. And it's already lasted considerably longer. I think you can see that at the end there. Than the spike empires which preceded it. Now, you'd have to say that it exists. I mean, looking at it from a kind of detached standpoint, you'd have to say that the European Union exists in an inhospitable environment of already formed, deeply entrenched states, most of which have distinct languages, all of which have distinct cultures, media, and political institutions. And yet the European Union has existed for some six decades. You see, depending on your perspective, depending on how you look at it, you can be surprised by some things that seem absolutely self-evident and obvious from a contemporary standpoint. And in this perspective, I think you can actually say that the European Union actually is a paragon, both as a touchstone of comparison and as an effort to achieve scale without force. So that's one perspective. And now I want to turn more directly to some of the research that I and Lisbeth Hoger have been doing on regional organizations. That is, international organizations composed of geographically proximate states. And in our ERC project, we look at some 73 now international organizations, of which 35 are regional organizations and the remainder are international or global organizations. And what we do is we ask a set of relatively straightforward questions of these organizations. How do they operate? What do they do? What are their competences? How do they make decisions? And I want to share with some of the findings with you right now to provide some very broad, basic comparison for the European Union. And this is one, this represents just nine regional organizations over the time that we track them. We track them from 1950 or whenever they were established until 2010. Now, what the scale on the left-hand side is delegation. And delegation is a variable that taps authority. It's an additive variable that is composed of the extent to which the bodies of the institution and their decision-making are independent from that of national states. That is, to what extent does a regional organization have a set of institutions, general secretariats, executives, could be more than one, assembly, parliament, court, that is independent of the member state that compose the organization. All the organizations we look at are composed of national states. They're state organizations. So the question we're asked is the first time that we have this data. To what extent, the simpler the question you ask in political science, and it's true elsewhere, I think, too, often the more elusive is the answer. So this is the extent to which regional organizations are independent. To what extent are they institutionalized? Are they authoritative? And what you see here is really quite remarkable. And it's not just these nine, but it stretches to almost all of the 35 regional organizations that we look at. And that is, they have gained in delegation, in authority, over the period with which we track them. They've gained in authority. So it really does look like, I mean, Ernie Haas and the neo-functionists are kind of, you know, should be happy about this, because that's precisely what they predicted, that there was some kind of logic, some kind of self-dynamic that would lead to growing authority on the part of regional organizations. Now, the basic reason for this, I've already specified in a very specific way. And that is, there are huge, there are massive, there are incontrovertible advantages to scale in the context of interaction among jurisdictions, among communities. If communities are interacting, they're going to create a whole variety of potential public goods and actual public bads. And the way, and those are public goods or public bads. And therefore, they require some kind of concerted effort to manage them. And that's precisely what we are seeing here. Which are the ones that, you know, not all of them have gone up. There are a few that that have not. So, for example, the Arab Maghreb Union is now defunct after complications, and Gaddafi ran it into the ground. There were big disagreements among the countries of northern Africa. The Comintern, that's another one that we have there, that ran to ground with the end of communism. So not every. Those are two organizations that are defunct. Three, including NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Association, have stagnated. But the remaining 30 have seen some kind of increase in delegation from the time they were set up to 2010. And they do exactly what one might expect them to do. They exploit scale among geographically proximate countries. They extend the scope of economic exchange. They deal with environmental problems. They coordinate transport. They facilitate mobility. They deepen the division of labor. And they provide security in different measures in different organizations. And they seem to discover cooperation over time, as the neo-functionalists predict. Now, why are they regional? Well, they're regional because in a sphere of life, international politics, where community is almost absent, what community do you find above the national state? Little. But where you do find community, it is among groups of proximate national states. I've got one here, just in case you notice it, the East African Community, which went to ground under Idi Amin and which was then resuscitated. And I have that in a separate slide. We can talk about some of these particular cases if you'd like to later. Why regional organization? Well, look, there's a sharp contrast between the international organization, the global organizations, which handle a very narrow range of policies, and these regional organizations, which tend to handle at least, you know, 12 to 15 on average. And the significance, the difference is very clear between these. International organizations, if you're going to have an organization that is going to cover a vast number of countries, it better be pretty narrow in its focus. It better handle goods that we call with greater optimality, where every member state, where some member states can be better off, but no member state is worse off. Pareto optimality. They are task specific. They handle problems like health, disease, migration, meteorological problems, a whole variety of problems for which experts can sit around and devise solutions. The regional organizations are very different. They handle a vast range of issues. They handle issues for which you need some kind of conflict resolution mechanisms. That's why they have assemblies and parliaments and executives that can handle the different ways in which countries can seek to solve their problems jointly. And they cover, these regional organizations cover much of the world. There are very few countries with populations over 5 million that do not belong to a regional organization. And the white for China, actually, there is the SCO in China, so that we should have one for China there also. There is a prediction. If you're thinking about, well, what's the pressure of scale? Now, the pressure of scale should be weaker in a much larger country. And so where are regional organizations relatively weak? Well, they're relatively weak for the United States. NAFTA is a pretty weak, that is, uninstitutionalized regional organization. SAARC, India, that links India and Pakistan, is also relatively weak. The Shanghai Cooperation, the SCO, for China and some neighbouring countries, that is pretty weak. And those, and that in Russia, the Commonwealth, CIS, is also pretty weak and run by Russia in a hegemonic way. Those large countries, very large countries, see less emergency, they see less need for a strong regional organisation. This is the aggregate picture among the regions, and the number of regional organisations is the red line, which has increased pretty steadily over this period. And then the average level of delegation is the blue line on the right-hand scale. And the point I really want to make here is that both have increased immensely, and there's one kind of interesting question that I think would deserve some further analysis, and that is the fact that delegation seems to be responsive to geopolitics. That is to say, it's the increase after the Second World War, and that's particularly in Europe, and the increase in the level of delegation at the end of the Cold War, the unfreezing of the Cold War, and the introduction of security problems, and particularly in Africa, where the rivalry of the great powers tended to suppress those. Well, this looks in more detail at the European Union, and there's a lot of information here, and I'm not going to... Every policy has a story. But what I want to take from this is, one, there's been a pretty unilinear increase in the competences of the European Union. This is based on a set of series of expert surveys. And what you see here in the legend is the red is exclusively national, so in 1950, the way in which problems were contained was at the national decided at the national level, and then things become more European as one moves on. Second thing I want you to take from this is that scale explains a lot of what has happened here. When you look at these particularly, let's say, in the area of trade, and then in the knock-on areas of welfare that are connected with the movement and mobility of populations in the labour market, work conditions, health, and so forth. The fact that trade negotiations, where scale is of obvious importance, was one of the first areas to become European. The European Union is a military dwarf. But it exerts considerable power, and I think this is worth emphasising. It exerts considerable power in the world economy by virtue of its scale, seeing eye to eye with the United States in negotiating the rules of world trade, banking regulation, industrial standardisation, environmental policy, telecommunications, and antitrust policy. So, for example, it's an extraterritorial competition policy. So, for example, the European Union blocked General Electric's purported takeover of Honeywell for $42 billion in the late 1990s, which was contested through the 2000s. So scale, not everything, because when you get to agriculture, the role of the European Union in the field of agriculture has much more to do with redistribution from urban to rural populations and across countries towards France and some others, but scale explains a lot of what we see here. There's another thing that I want to pull out too, and that is at a certain point, one is not simply dealing with the functional logic of scale, but one is dealing with a fundamental transformation of the polity in which one is living, and that engages community. And so, unlike the other regional organizations, The European Union is an organisation that engages policy on such a broad front that it starts to energise groups of individuals who feel that their sovereignty, that their national authenticity has been undermined. And that really is the message of this slide. That is to say, let's put the European Union on that slide that I showed you just a few minutes ago. And it's right out there, up the top. It is by far the most broadly competent of all of those regional regimes. So it shows you can't simply extrapolate, you know, look like ever upward. But the European Union has a fundamentally different dynamic by virtue that since the Maastricht Accord of 1992, it has been perceived, I think rightly, as a major incursion on national authority. It engages issues of community in a way that was never present prior to the 1990s, when you could talk about permissive consensus, a kind of lack of interest and knowledge on the part of the populations that were part of the European community in those days. So community is now at the heart, scale, yes, but community also is now at the heart of Europe and European decision making. And I want to I want to begin with the state of play. Okay, community. That is, how do European individuals perceive themselves in terms of where they belong? Where do they see yourself? And this is the summary of Eurobarometer information. It's the question that's often used to describe identity in a very kind of simple and very kind of straightforward way. And what you see is that, well, about 10%, 9% in this graph, 10% often, individuals say that they are European only or European, more European than national. That's about 50 million people. But, of course, as you can see, the mode is individuals who think of themselves as more national than European, and there's a large minority who conceive of themselves as national only. Now, what does that mean? Well, you know, you have to figure out what it means, because responding to a survey that you're national only, or I'm British only, or German only, or French only, what does that actually mean? And that becomes the substance of politics, of contest. What does it mean? Can you be English and European at the same time, or French and European? These are contested. These are debated. Let me just say this. I mean, I teach in the United States, over a long period of time, and I ask this question to my American students. I mean, how does that question sound when you're asking that in America? Do you feel North Carolinian only, or more American than Carolinian? And you go through the questions, and it's exactly reversed. The only individuals in a big class that I would teach who would say, I mean, nobody would say that they're North Carolinian only, but there are some Texans who say that they are more Texan than American. But you'd only find one or two in a class that would say that. But everybody would be in one of those, in one of these two. I'm sorry. And not in these. Not in those. It's exactly the mirror picture of that in Europe. And that shows you how far Europe would have to go to be anything like the United States. Absolutely and completely unimaginable under present circumstances. This, I think, is an interesting graph. It's taken from Sarah Hobart's book and James Tilley. And what it shows is the kind of the interconnectedness, the way in which what your attitude over the European Union influences the way you attribute blame, that these things are so closely connected, and the difference here is around 30%. That is, those people who are EU opponents are much more likely to say that the EU is responsible for the current crisis. And so what you think about a particular object affects how you think about it. Maybe Sarah can say some more about that later in the question time. But the way in which you blame is quite responsive to events. The way in which one thinks of one's identity is pretty stable. And the kind of, what are the, when we're thinking about identity and community, what are the kinds of time scales that we're thinking of? Well, it's mostly generations. I mean, that's, financial crises move in real time. But the way in which people think about the groups to which they belong, where they think about who is us and who is them, how should we be ruled in terms of self-rule, that changes much more slowly. But it does change. And so in a way, the game of Europe is to say, okay, well, given the pressure of the current crisis, is there enough time for a new generation to come into play? This graph, actually, this is produced from the research of one of my and Lisbeth's students, Florian Sokol, who's working on his PhD. This is very interesting, and it's an experiment. And it takes Erasmus students who have spent one term or two terms in a different European university versus an experimental group who could have gone on the Erasmus program but did not. And it says, well, has that affected their identity? And the answer is, yeah, it does. Not hugely, but in a way that can be detected. There's a rather kind of large, significant bars there, but on average, yeah. Spending, it's the basic argument of neo-functionalism. That is, where you have transactional interconnections, where you have transnational interaction that's positive, so you can get, first of all, an understanding, a sympathy with those other individuals, and potentially some kind of overarching commitment. And European identity is responsive. And there are a number of other studies that suggest this, and also some also that, quite honestly, that challenge it. But the changes are relatively small, and the changes are relatively slow. And then look at this. This is the labour mobility, and it reveals just how low labour mobility is in the European Union. If you're thinking about transaction, and the argument is Europe facilitates mobility, it facilitates the melding of populations that were previously isolated or separate, and this itself has some effect on creating some overarching identity. Well, you'd have to take this into account, and that is that mobility in Europe, across the states of Europe compared to the states of the United States, is barely one-tenth that of the United States. Barely one-tenth. And that also works within Europe, within European countries, relatively little mobility. There was some time back where there was a report in the BBC, I don't know whether you remember this, it was a couple of years ago, at least a couple of years ago, where they dug up a skeleton. Anthony told me this, actually. They dug up a skeleton in Wales. It was 10,000 years old, and the local school teacher was a direct descendant. I mean, mobility, geographical mobility. So Europeans are much more rooted. I mean, that obviously was, a coincidence in some sense. But when I have an American class in front of me, and they, they're in Chapel Hill, and most of them don't expect even to be in North Carolina by the time they go into the labour market. They really is a people move on average less than every 5 years in the United States across states. Vastly more labour mobility. And if you were to start to kind of take this argument forward, into economics, you'd have one of the keys to the rigidity of the European response to differential unemployment rates across European countries, right, which are far, far greater than in the United States. Because if there's unemployment in New York and labour demand in Florida, people will move. But obviously it is much, much more difficult in Europe because of those cultural linguistic differences. This is another kind of slow-moving process, and that is education. Education makes a difference. That people, individuals who leave school when they're older than 19, are 2.5 times more likely to say that they are more European than national or European only. So that's quite a big difference. There's other stuff. This is just bivariate. So it's not controlled. The Stuckel graph controlled for a variety of other factors. This doesn't. So there's some income factors that, you know, we need to control here. But the finding is pretty robust. Education leads individuals to a greater orientation towards Europe. This summarizes the same information. And then this is composed of a whole variety. The information here is derived from Eurobarometer for over 10 years. And on the left scale, it's more national and more European. And older people tend to be more national, and younger people tend to be more European. Now, this could be life cycle. I don't think it is. It could be that when you get old, I don't see it in myself, when you get old, you become more national. Or younger people are more European, and as they move through, they retain that Europeanness, and maybe the people who are younger yet are yet more European. But whatever the outcome, and again this is contested, but however you read this, it will take a long time for the population of Europe to think of themselves as European in relation to being national. I wanted to, given the fact that I've worked extensively on political parties, I wanted to bring in political parties into this because you have an identity, but the way it's mobilized matters a lot. And political parties are influential here. Now, this is just the basic economic left, economic right. It's related to this welfare state and distribution. What's the role of the state in the society? How much redistribution there should be? Left parties, right parties. And then there's the second dimension, which is a social left-right, which goes from TAN, traditional authoritarian national, to GAL, green alternative libertarian, at the top. And so you can place parties in this grid. And what we do in Chapel Hill, this is called the Chapel Hill Expert Survey. We ask more than 1,000 experts to rate more than 200 parties in 28 countries on a whole variety of different policies. So there's a vast amount of information, and we do this every 2, 3, 4 years. And this is just the most recent one that we have available. Well, what you see here is this. Parties of the middle tend to be pro-EU, and the opposition has its source in two kinds of parties. One, radical left parties, that is parties who object to Europe on the basis of redistribution, that is a capitalist, I don't want to say conspiracy, but a capitalist regime. And those were populist right parties and some conservative parties, the British Conservatives are there, UKIP is there, who object to the EU on grounds of community, on grounds that the EU brings cosmopolitan influences in national community, that it brings immigration in, that it undermines national sovereignty, it undermines national control, it undermines self-rule. That is the kind of the big message, simple message of populist right parties. Now, you may think, well, OK, parties respond to popular preferences, but they don't just respond to them, they actually influence them. And again, this is the work of two students, former students, Erica Edwards and Catherine De Vries, now professors. And EU support is on a thermometer scale on the vertical axis. And this is the strength of the Eurosceptic party queue. How strong is a radical right party in the country? And what you see is this, that in countries where the radical right party is strong, whatever identity you have, whether it's an inclusive identity, I feel European and national, or an exclusive identity, I feel English only, whatever your identity is, you're less likely to support the European Union in countries where the radical right party is strong. Now there's a bit of feedback. There's a bit of, in the professional jargon, there's a bit of endogeneity here. But there's not much. Parties affect how individuals conceive their identity in political terms. This is my last picture and one more graph to be, and then we can open things up. And this is the most important of all, in a sense, because if you were to ask me what has been the political effect of Europe on domestic politics, I would say the greatest effect has been to strengthen populist demands for referendums on European issues in the belief that national parliaments are not able to make decisions on their own. They're not legitimate. And I come from a country, I'm a Londoner, I come from a country where I was taught, and maybe you still are, I don't know, that we live in a parliamentary democracy where parliament is sovereign. I mean, that's not true. On the important issues, we need to go to a referendum. We cannot accept the final legitimacy of the House of Commons in Parliament. And what you've seen here is a stark increase in the number of referendums. These are the referendums having to do with the treaties, not referendums of whether you want to join or not. So these are referendums about reform. And what you see is, first of all, the number increases, but the extent to which governments which put the referendum on the agenda are defeated. 6 out of 10. That's a pretty poor batting. 6 out of 10. The Treaty of Nice defeated in Ireland. The euro defeated in Denmark and Sweden. This is all between 2001 and 2010. And the European Constitution defeated in the country where I'm resident, the Netherlands and France. And the Lisbon Treaty defeated in Ireland. This notion of the referendum is a very tough thing to resist. I remember when Chirac was really trying to resist calling a referendum. And when other people in your party, particularly, are saying, hey, let the people speak, it's not easy. It has actually been done by the Labour leader. But it's not easy. I mean, that's an interesting decision, and we can talk about that later. It's a very interesting decision. But it's very difficult to resist saying, no, I don't think the people should speak. Mm. We representatives, we're the ones who should decide this. And so there was this lovely little interchange between Blair and Chirac, where Chirac didn't want to have a referendum. Blair turned around and said, yes, in Britain we'll have a referendum, in the hope that the referendum would get defeated in France and he wouldn't have to have one, which is exactly what happened. So you call a referendum because you're hoping that it'll get defeated somewhere else and you won't have to do it. But this is absolutely, absolutely fundamental. Why is it absolutely fundamental? Because, and now I'm kind of coming into the crisis, most of the ways of dealing with the crisis involve fundamental institutional reform. They involve a banking union. They involve fiscal union. But how can you have those unless you have referendums? I mean, that's the, if I had to put my finger on, you know, the challenge, the puzzle of Europe, that would be it. So to what extent can one have reform by eluding, by finessing referendums? It's extremely difficult. And once you start playing the referendum game, I mean, almost the worst thing that could happen is that the major interest groups, the trade unions, the employers, both of the major parties, or all the major parties, almost the worst thing that could happen is they come out in favour. Why? Because then it becomes an elite populist dynamic, and the populist right parties have a field day in resisting this elite control. Referendums are also interesting on other grounds, and to be, you know, now I'm talking ethically, I think they reduce politics. They take the art of politics out of politics, because the art of politics is to craft compromises, not to splice issues into yes or no. It's to have forward thinking. It's to think about the implications, the consequences of particular pieces of legislation or decisions. And not only that, but the information that one needs to make informed decisions about referendums, about those issues, is often lacking. So what happens, and we know this from political psychology, so what happens is that individuals kind of retreat or base themselves on their priors, on their gut. Maybe it's whether they like the government or not. Or maybe, and often more likely, it is how they think of their own identity. If you ask a 6-year-old child what their nationality is, you'll get the correct answer. If you ask an adult which party they voted for in the last election, only 80 to 90% will give you the right answer. I mean, the way in which we think of our identity, the groups to which we belong and hold allegiance, the groups that are outgroups, this is very, very deeply ingrained. And there's some lovely experiments, could never be conducted now, in which a professor takes a class, divides it into two. These are ad hoc, artificial groups, and then plays those groups against each other. Human beings have a propensity to see themselves as members of groups and to take those groups very seriously. This is a big topic that's deeply related to the causal role of community in shaping government. Okay, I'm going to finish with three kind of big consequences of this line of argument, and then we can throw it open. The first is, you know, if you're a political leader, and or you're sitting around the table with the other European leaders, and one of the leaders turns around and says, okay, let's have a fiscal union, we're going to do this, let's have a basic treaty change, what you're going to do as a leader is think, oh my goodness, in my country, do I have to have a referendum or not? If you have to have a referendum, you're in a world of uncertainty. A world of uncertainty. And that has been, if you think about how the crisis has been handled, I mean, what has been going on? This kind of you might call it institutional flexibility or creativity or escape from major treaty reform. The establishment of the European Financial Stability Facility in 2010. I mean, this was the first attempt to create a bulwark behind member state debt. What was it? A limited liability company created in Luxembourg with a manager, with shareholders. I mean, it's a limited liability company under Luxembourg law. The ESM, the European Stability Mechanism, is a separate international organization, separately established. What has been the major institution that's been responsible? It's the European Central Bank. That is an organization that kind of sits at the side, a technocratic organization that has no democratic basis. So, avoid grand treaties. What does that mean? Well, I think at some point, you know, they're going to have to face up to this. Even in Germany now, there is a debate about whether there should be a referendum. Germany is one of the countries that's avoided all referendums since the Second World War for very good historical reasons. Now that's up for grabs, because both the CSU, the sister party of the CDU in Bavaria, which is pretty anti-EU, wants a referendum. You can understand why. And even some social democrats are calling for that as well. Multi-level governance light. It means that governments are European governments. You may not you know, believe this or think this, but believe me, it's true. They are pretty light governments. This is a light jurisdiction. The European Union is a response to the following question. How can one realise the benefits of scale while accommodating diverse national communities? And the answer, in short, is to tax little and redistribute less. I mean, we're talking about 1%, only 1% of total EU GDP. The US federal government, talking about 12% thereabouts of US GDP. Use soft law, OMC benchmarking. Legislate by directive rather than by uniform legislation. And even then, allow member states to, in the phrase, include themselves out by derogation. And then the split, which I see as almost inevitable. Not the split within the Eurozone, but the split between the European Union and the Eurozone. Because whatever the UK decides in terms of its membership of the European Union, there is going to be a growing crevice, a growing gap between the Eurozone, where there are enormous functional pressures for deeper integration, and the European Union, including the UK, which will have two kinds of states in it. One, states that see the European Union as an antechamber to eventual membership of the Eurozone, and those that do not. So the European Union is going to be much more diverse than the notion that the European Union is a coherent single entity. I'm going to conclude but before I do, I want to open things up in the sense of stressing that prediction of how member states are going to... I've sketched a situation of constraints on member states, of an enormous pressure of scale, which I don't see diminishing, particularly in the Eurozone, where a banking union and a fiscal union are really on the agenda, which the scale pressures for these are absolutely enormous, and yet resisted by equally enormous, equally impressive constraints of community. But the one thing that I've kind of learnt in politics is that this is not the kind of the outcome, but a frame for creative decision-making. For the bulk of Europe's history, as I noted at the beginning, empire has been associated with coercive subjugation of unwilling peoples. But the experience of the European Union, and everything I know about the European Union, suggests that government reflects not only circumstances, but human ingenuity in dealing with them. Well, with that, let me stop here and let's throw things open for any comments or questions that you have. Thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for this stimulating and very wide-ranging talk. And thank you for taking this question, Marijke Klein, first.
Yeah, thanks very much for your lecture. And let me first say that I absolutely applaud the effort of putting the European Union in a comparative perspective, because there is actually a lot, first of all, that other regions of the world can learn from the European Union, but perhaps even the other way around, things that the European Union can learn from other experiments and governments. But you mentioned towards the end, again, the historical perspective. And I think that especially the historical perspective also raises a couple of questions and challenges a little bit your argument, which in my view was a classic function on a scale explains the movement towards greater communal, greater regional integration. But I think it also, what it cannot explain is really the historical dynamics, right? Why does it go back? Why does it happen at a certain point of time and not at another point of time? So I just wanted to throw in a potential alternative explanation that perhaps it's more about domestic factors that really explain the push towards regional organization, because we also see that it's correlated, especially the recent wave of regional integration is correlated with an increasing democratization of the world. And we also know that democracies tend to demand public goods much more than autocratic regimes, and democracies are also more likely to cooperate with each other and also in a much deeper way. So this could also be an alternative explanation for what you're describing. I was also wondering about the, or perhaps I just wasn't quite, I didn't quite understand your concept of empire. It seems that for you, regional organization is defined also by a level of centralization, but I'm just wondering to what extent centralization is really absolutely necessary in order to achieve certain public goods also over a broader range, because what was sort of missing from the various organizations or empires that you mentioned was the Hanseatic technique, which created a very, very wide market across diverse cities of a very arguably large scales without necessarily centralizing. So to what extent is this really necessary? And also in terms of scope, is it really necessary for a regional organization really to expand in scope, given that having more sectors or including sectors is actually a WTO requirement for allowing regional organizations to form to begin with? I think that's already enough questions. Others I can ask you later.
Do you want to start with that?
Good. I'll take them backwards. The Hanseatic League is really fascinating because it was an alternative to a possible alternative to the creation of the national state. And Hendrik Sprout, I don't know if you know his work on precisely that, is pretty interesting. It kind of illustrates the problem of creating a public good in the context of decentralization. Because what happens, for example, when you make an agreement that has differential costs for the members? See, that's why the Hanseatic League, one of the reasons why the Hanseatic League had such difficulty in sustaining itself. It was a wonderful idea. I mean, and there was a lot of trade across the north of Europe. But where it failed was in the organized use of coercion. And there, you know, you have a pure public good, that is to say, this is non-rival and non-excludable, and it's enormously difficult to mobilize serious coercion in a decentralized frame. It's the same, you know, you have the same problem in a whole variety of different fora. I mean, the WTO is an organization which is broadly encompassing, but extraordinarily difficult to get people to avoid free riding. And so what you have is a whole variety of different kind of court systems that are designed to, in a relatively decentralized decision frame, to be able to impose agreements on the individual actors. And what we've seen, actually, one of the kind of stories of the development of regional organization is that the court systems that they have created have become much stronger over the period that I showed there, both in with respect to imposing some kind of penalty on governments, and in terms of allowing individuals who are not governments to take cases to those courts. So the Hanseatic League, I think, to go back to that, is a kind of a wonderful experiment that failed because there was not an effective way of making people, that is the sitters, Lübeck and all the others, by the agreements that were made. On democracy, you know, I think, you know, interestingly, we don't actually we take that delegation as a dependent variable in a multivariate analysis, and what we find some effect for democracy, but it's actually it's not terribly robust, which is surprising, because I think your line of argument, that is, democracy should be more open to transferring authority out of their own hands than autocracies. And there's a reason for that, and that is an autocrat sees any kind of arena in which others can gain authority, power, as a competitor. So autocrats are much more likely to centralise authority into their own hands. So I buy the logic of your question, Marika. But what we find as more powerful is the extent to which, in terms of the depth of delegation, that's the dependent variable, the extent to which those countries are on the same plane. So, for example, did they ever experience a federal polity? See, in Central America, not democracies, the Central American Association, which is a very strong regional organization. Costa Rica is a democracy, but the others are very highly undemocratic, and yet they've sustained a pretty strong regional organization. In Latin America, you've seen the development of military regimes, which have, which have been party to regional organizations. So I think democracy is a factor, but I think the extent to which you have a shared community, another factor in terms of a shared community, is whether a group of countries experienced the same colonial power and had to join in a fight for their own autonomy. That seems to be an important factor in the strength of regional organization. There's one thing that I actually, in terms of your, just let me add as a footnote, in terms of your work on informality, I think it fits rather nicely into the notion of a light polity, because as you argue, and I think you're absolutely right, there is an informal agreement in the European Union. This is Marika's argument, that where a government has to pay serious domestic costs for a particular policy, there is a willingness to tolerate derogation. Is that your argument? And that actually is something that that fits the kind of the light frame of European integration. That is to say, you've got rules about super majoritarian decision making, but there's a willingness on the part of government to say, okay, we might have a qualified majority, but we're not going to put you, this government, on the on the fire domestically if it's really going to be costly to that government.
Damien Chalmers.
Damien Chalmers, I found it a really thought-provoking and wonderful talk. I think I have two questions, if I may. And one is about the relationship you drew at the end between referenda and EU integration. And the division you drew between scale, those functional demands, and community, sociologists might make between life, world, and system, there might be between government and body politic in some political theory, and so on. It's a very interesting and very powerful one. I find it again and again and again. Now, of course, many of the sociologists, when they make the distinction between government and life world, or government and political community, or government, and I suppose we could say democracy, seeing an inexorable move towards greater government and the collapse of political community. This is what they think has really happened since the Second World War. And it's obviously coterminous with the growth of regional integration. I may only talk about it and make something like that. And you at the end gave a more optimistic note that you saw political communities biting back in referenda. And I suppose my question a little bit is why? I mean, I'm not, I myself have no strong view about the relationship. And my second question is a different one. And it was to do with, I think it was when you showed geopolitics and the growth of regional organisations. And that coincided, of course, the second date, the end of the Cold War, with the creation of the WTO. And what happened with the creation of the WTO, and I completely agreed on your arguments on that, was actually the growth of Article 24 regional agreements.
Yeah.
In a spectacular way. But these weren't regional organisations in the way that we associate the EU. When one looked at them, they were all regional organisation agreements that either had the EU or the US with some hegemony. So the US was the war on drugs and various deals with places like Colombia. The EU was all the neighbourhood and association and crossing agreements. And I wondered whether those sorts of agreements, which in some cases are actually more wide-ranging and institutionalised than some of the regional organisations on this, whether they would fit into your analysis as well.
Now, which did you... What do you have in mind? Which ones?
Well, if one was to think about the association agreements with Turkey, the customs union of Turkey, some of the Cotonou institutional arrangements, the wide array of activities they get. I know the Mercosur reasonably well, and actually, if you looked at it on the level of policy sectors, I could make a case that these are more wide-ranging than Mercosur. Central America is very institutionalised, that's true, but they also don't have many roads between Central American states. They're very weak. So if you actually look to the level of transactions in terms of exchange, it's weak, whereas it's not between, say, Turkey and the EU. Now, that doesn't, I mean, in my view, it actually strengthens your argument, Fulmer's argument, that there are these new hybrid organisations rather than anything. I just wanted to get a view on that.
Yeah. Let me begin with your first question about a community and community bites back. You know, community is a community could have was kind of ignored, was actually definitely ignored until the kind of the breakdown of the post Second World War system. After World War II, you couldn't talk about ethnicity and community. Borders were stuck. So Marty Lipset, who I mentioned right at the very beginning, enormously influential political scientist, never talked about a community. What he talked about was class conflict within existing societies. And if you were, if you had your base in social science of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, what you'd be talking about is states as kind of virtually fixed and conflicts within them, class conflicts very often. And essentially what has happened is that post-war consensus on avoiding talk of ethnicity, of community, of the jurisdictional frame has frayed. And so now community, I mean, community is raised in all sorts of contexts. But particularly in Europe, in the context of a new jurisdictional frame, which puts member states and their and everything that the depth of institutions that member states have erected in question. And so the community that I'm talking about within in the context of Europe is an imagined community. So it's not the community of bowling clubs. In Putnam's terms, and that kind of community, that is the interconnectedness in small groups, in churches, in unions, in bowling clubs, that I think, you know, there's a lot of evidence that has declined. But the community that is attested in terms of the imagined fellowship in the context of growing levels of immigration and growing levels of reform that change the structure, I think that has become absolutely absolutely fundamental. And what I talked about here was the supranational element of that, but one finds that also within countries and in terms of subnational politics. I mean, right now in the UK with respect to Scotland and in Spain with respect to Catalonia and in one country after the other, one's finding the mobilisation of subnational territorial communities in a way that was never expected right after in the 1950s or after World War II. In terms of the institutional arrangements, if I understand, you know, I think there are a number of... You're absolutely right about the WTO. I mean, the WTO in 1993 essentially restricted the ability to have preferential trade agreements to regional organisations, and I think there's an argument that unleashed a move towards regional organisation and preferential trade agreements within that context. That was the legal context. But interestingly, many of the regional organisations are not trade organisations. So when you think of regional organisations, then there's scholarly literature on this. It's and that literature goes under the name of liberal institutionalism. The focus is very much on there are countries that trade with each other. They want to lower the transaction barriers to trade, and therefore they create regional organizations that constrain protectionism, that constrain import tariffs and various kinds of quotas. That's the kind of the European Union frame. But you mentioned CICA, and there are many other organizations where the transaction, the communications within are not very strong, and where these regional organizations are much more oriented outwards. That is in terms of the terms of trade for raw materials that are exported. If you take various African countries, say take the countries in the European, EAC, East African Union, they're essentially primary producers. So it's not trade among those countries that is generating the demand for a regional organization, but rather security and negotiating with external actors, and particularly negotiating in terms of getting foreign aid. So I think there's a variety of different reasons, different pressures for the creation of these regional organizations. I think partially we'll have a discussion later about some of the intricacies of that.
Question up there. Up here, yes. Chris.
Hi. Thanks a lot. Christopher Vratil, from the European Institute, PhD student. You said at the end of your talk, you were saying, suggesting national identity puts a robust constraint on European integration in some sense, especially when we have no information about integration, people don't know exactly what it is like. They lack this, then they fall back on their priors, and national identity is one of these priors, as well as party cues. And I'm just wondering, the dynamic we have seen is totally this, that the right-wing parties, extreme right-wing, extreme left-wing parties, are trying to mobilize this national identity. But by this process, to some extent, a debate is created. And this debate disseminates information about integration. And I'm just wondering, may it be that this is just the first cycle of the story, and in the next cycle, people actually come back from their, take some distance to their priors and actually start to more rationally engage with the project.
But just this one, the gentleman in front also wanted a question, and that can then be the final question of tonight. Please.
I was wondering, two surprising statistics that you had in there was the number of people as opposed to in the United States see themselves as American first. And do you think that will, in the European Union, change to a considerable degree in any time in the near future? And then the other statistic was the labor mobility of 0.2%. And I was wondering how you measured that, because there's, Polish people, there's 900,000 in the UK. So it seems like there are a lot of people who are moving to other countries to work. But exactly how is that determined on the labor mobility? Thank you.
Okay. Interesting questions. Chris, first of all, will the debate generate information? Will it be... will it be fruitful? I think that's a great, it's a great PhD topic. I mean, what we have, the future we can't tell, but what we have are, we know about referendums in California. The less said, the better, in a sense. I mean, a horrific experience in California. In Switzerland, which is a mixed experience, we have referendums in the interwar period used by dictators for very precise ends. And so there is a literature, on referendums. And then there's, a more interesting literature on debate and the context in which debate can lead to the changing of opinions of the people engaged in that debate. And essentially, I think the conclusion that I draw from that literature is that the smaller the group within reason, the more the debate can actually construct, can lead people to deconstruct and reconstruct their opinions. And the more massified that debate, the less that happens. When people are simply consumers in a mass debate, you know, they kind of get what they, in a sense, they get what they, that they're fed, but their attention is very low. And actually, Sarah, on her book and the analysis of media, will reveal very clearly that, and that was the graph that I showed from her book, that people kind of are very attentive to things that fit with their preconceptions. And so it's a, you know, it's a very interesting topic. But I'm pretty skeptical of the extent to which these debates really lead to more and better information on the part of individuals. I mean, we're going to have one soon in the UK. The interesting thing is, right in the UK, that most people don't know that there's going to be a referendum were the Conservatives to win the next election. I mean, 20% only know that there's going to be something like that. Is that there's going to be a referendum? So one could actually do a study. There are studies, panel surveys, where you're looking at the same set of individuals over time and evaluating their levels of information and whether they do change their opinions. It's a very interesting topic. Then the question of will European identity grow? Well, what I showed would suggest that over time it would grow. That's the bottom line, but slowly. But I have to admit that there's not a heck of a lot of sign of that in the past 10 or 20 years. Now, the information that we have is pretty constrained temporally, because the question that I had there, that simple question, first of all, this question is very simple, but it was only asked since 1992, I think. And so, you know, we don't have a long time series, and you'd have to look at individuals much more closely to really figure out, you know, what their identity means. And of course, identity is contextual. It's mobilized in particular context. When I'm sitting here, you know, I feel quite differently in terms of my identity to when I'm sitting in the Netherlands, and very differently from when I'm sitting in Chapel Hill. So I think my what I draw from the literature is, were the status quo of European integration to continue for an extended period of time, with Erasmus and a whole variety of policies that facilitate mobility, identity would grow, but slowly. But that time scale is not the time scale at which events happen. And so it's as if we are kind of holding our breath, if you're pro-EU, while there's a heck of a lot that is exogenous that's affecting how individuals perceive the European Union. With respect to labour mobility, I think you raise a good point. The figures that I have were for the last figures I could get were 2007, and I'm certain that it's, you know, that labour mobility has increased, and you're taking the one example where it's increased the most, because the UK was open to the source of the greatest potential mobility, that is the countries of the east of the European Union. But it's higher than the figures I showed, but still a heck of a lot less than the United States. Good question.
Thank you so much. And on that note, we've unfortunately run out of time, but I think you'll join me in thanking Gary Marks for this wonderful and stimulating and interesting talk. So thank you.
Thank you.